There we go.
Hey, Brent, how are you doing, man? You started drinking yet?
I'm a little hungover.
Really? Okay.
Last night was you know, our twice a month developers get together. So I blame
Paris. Did the Seattle. Oh, yeah. That's my business partner, by the way.
Yes.
Ladies and gents. So, yeah.
You can tell our sprint has ended because I didn't know Brent was out last night.
Yeah. Our 6 month or 7 month sprint.
That's a very long sprint.
Yeah. How's software land for you kids?
Well, we ship. I'm one tired person, one tired programmer, you know. So I'm looking forward to my little WWDC vacation. Big time.
Yeah. I think it's going to be fun. And we've got a ton of opportunity to hang out, the three of us, and drink and eat good food. So,
yep, totally.
So just to actually make this a show rather than the just, you know, a bunch of us hanging out.
We should do this more.
We should. And honestly, we could probably just make a show of us just talking shit about whatever the hell we wanted. But
you're saying that people will just listen to anything these days. They just don't care anymore.
Oh, yeah.
That's been proven, Brent.
It's like a podcasting dream team right here. It's
called reality TV.
Dumb Central. Dumb City.
Yeah, we should do one, start with all of us, and then vote one of us out each week. And
We should just call it One Star. It's perfect.
I liked Reliable Flavor Profile. As a
Reliable. What an awful thought. Anyway, if you tuned in to hear about software, Brent, you've been doing a sync diary for Vesper.
Yeah.
Do you want to walk us through that a little bit?
Sure. Or and at the same time,
about reliable
profiles. Yeah. So step one with syncing is to talk about it incessantly on your blog.
Right.
And that's been really great because number one, I love blogging. It's always fun for me. And it's even better when I have something to actually blog about.
Right.
There's a lot of design stuff to figure out. And I figured that I should actually really like think about it in advance and write it down and have a good solid design. And so why not press publish at the same time? Because that way, you know, other people might learn things, but even more importantly, they might teach me things. So I actually got a ton of good feedback, which went into, you know, big and small details of how Vesper syncing works. So it was a really, really nice thing for me and for all of us to go through that process.
So was being public sort of part of the process there? In that, like, you know, you kind of put yourself on the line and you're like, this is what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you almost dare everybody to tell you that you're an idiot, right?
Okay. Yeah, sure. But the thing is, nobody ever does that to me.
No, of course not. Yeah. Not to you.
No, not to me. I could be a really big idiot. It doesn't matter.
No, don't you think it's the case though that even if, let's say, you are being an idiot and mm-hmm. you get halfway through writing it up, it's the act of writing it up usually uncovers the idiocy, and before you even have a chance to publish it, you've thought through and you see, oh, here it is. Here's why I'm being a dummy.
Right.
Right?
Isn't
that's like a big part of the appeal.
Yeah, and that's totally how it worked for me. I would sit down, start writing up how I'm going to do X, and halfway through writing it, realize I'm not going to do it that way at all. I'm going to do it, you know, this other way.
So would you kill that piece, or would you just...
No, I would just work on it until I figured out the answer and then publish it.
So you'd work on the piece of writing?
Yeah. Yeah, the writing...
Explain it, and then you would go and do the actual code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fascinating. That I know, John, you've said before that your writing comes out from you trying to explain shit effectively, or like trying to work out your thoughts on stuff.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that
even whether it's punditry or whether it's a technical explanation, it's like you want to have a strong opinion loosely held when you go into any sort of essay, blog post, article type thing, because if you should have a point you're trying to make, but you should keep your mind open, because it's always surprising to me how many times the act of writing it, I change my mind because writing is thinking, and once I've thought it through, I realize, hey, I've got a different opinion now than when I've started.
Right.
or I've come to a different conclusion than I thought I was going to when I started.
I think it's probably similar to the idea that if you can teach it, you actually know it, or at least a good teacher comes to understand the subject better than they had even before they taught people.
This is the entire premise of Ken Ferry's app, Understudy, where as you're learning something, you teach it at the same time to the next person in the line so that you're reinforcing what you was in your head right now.
Yeah, precisely. And good plug. Ken Ferry, previous guest on the show. Good guy.
We'll send him an invoice.
Not a dummy.
Pick up a drink from him, you know, next week. So what sucks, Brent? What was awful?
What was awful? Well, it really took a long time. And I think that kind of the wonderful part of it and the sucky part of it are both somewhat the same thing, sure. Which is that there are a whole bunch of different pieces to this. And I couldn't actually see any of it in action until I put all the pieces together. And so, you know, I'm kind of not flying blind is the wrong word because I had a design. I knew it all together, but not being able to see the results until near the very end it required a lot of patience and a lot of faith in my own ability and in the design. And then when it did all come together at the end and I saw it working, you know, minus a few small bugs here and there, that part was wonderful. That was the absolute best part. But the sucky part was having to be patient for all those months until I could actually see it working.
It's funny talking about the sync diary stuff a minute ago, because so many times somebody would come up to me at a conference or whatever and say, it was the same joke over and over. I bet you guys would be done by now if Brent would just stop blogging so much. When the opposite is true, that was a very big part of the process. And the truth is, even if you're worried about the time or something, those are the same reports that Brent would send to us at the end of the day to let us know where he was in the process.
Well, were they really like copy and paste like that?
Well, not copy paste. They're a little bit more, you know, written, a little bit more stylized, but it was the same information. It's not like he was sitting down thinking, I'm going to write a post on, you know, core data today. It was the exact same stuff we were discussing. It wasn't even like if I'm looking at it as project manager, worrying about how somebody's spending their time, it's still absolutely the best way to spend your time.
Right. That's cool. So
I should also point out that part of me doing this, you know, I mentioned having to be very patient for a long time. So part of me doing this was kind of to help with my personal morale because I love writing and love blogging so much. You know, when I'm way heads down, way deep in something and, you know, far away from actually, submitting any software, it just made me feel good to be able to write about it and hit publish.
Yeah. You've been writing. It seems like this gave you an excuse to kind of have dialogue or more, mm-hmm. Right? Because it seemed like you had stopped writing for a while. Not right, stopped, but.
Yeah, I've never stopped.
It was infrequent,
months.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
So nice to have you back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Yeah. You got stuck with sync.
also, as a three-man company, it's a one-man engineering department.
That was my next kind of question, which was like, what have you and John been doing recently? Basically just twiddling your thumbs. There's like you guys were just like, hey, Brent, why don't you go cook up some sync and we'll be over here having pancakes. like what's the process there?
We've just been drinking a lot. No, there's a lot of thought that goes into what sync means to the user and how the user does things like resetting their password. And what does the page for resetting your password look like? And how many times do you need to enter your password? And what happens if you forget? You know, all these things are things that they're not. I mean, there's technical components to them, but a lot of it is design discussion. And where do you put the button for that thing? And you know, how does that form get laid out? And how much sync UI is exposed to the user? And then what happens in all of the cases where we can't connect to the server or your password is invalid? Any of these things can affect what's displayed to you in the app. So not just the technical side of making the thing work, but you know, there's how little UI can we possibly show you?
So,
but it's true. I would say this though, it is true that we've been less we had a stretch there. I'd say at the beginning of like calendar 2014, we had less to do than at any point in the process.
Absolutely.
Because we didn't want to race ahead and do other things and start designing, you know, the Mac version of the app or something like that months and months ahead of when it was going to get done. I mean, you know, there was definitely a waiting involved.
Yeah, I would just make it funny.
And it was even strange for me because I'm really bad. Like one thing I'm just terrible at is when something I've done, I don't know what, you know, a month, 2 months, somewhere around 2 months, anything I've done becomes old and it's no longer fresh in my head. And we did all these sync screens, you know, what it looks like to log in, what's the difference between creating a new account, signing into an existing account. At least, I don't know, 2 months, maybe even 3 months ahead of when we actually got to play with it in a version of the app that worked. And it all felt like, wow, that was a long time ago. And I couldn't remember the why of why we made certain decisions.
And it really was all done. We'd finished all those screens, but I don't think a single one of them, I don't think a single decision survived the last month.
It's like the mental equivalent to me of like, once you're wet in the pool, you can jump back in easily. But then once you're totally dry, it's like you've got to start all over again. And it felt like that getting back into the flow of how we want to design that.
So when Brent went away, walked through fire, had scorpions bite him or sting him, came out with an app finally. And you're like, yeah, this doesn't work. Like, did he implement everything the way that you kind of said, and you were, after having played with it, you'd made different decisions, or was it like a time-based thing or what?
I think it's really when you have something in your hands, your feelings about it change, or assumptions are now challenged and you have to go back and change some stuff. And it's not like Brent was off and chained up in a basement somewhere and we didn't speak to him for months. It was, there's a lot of back and forth conversation, but everything changes the moment finger touches a glass.
Yeah, but it was interesting what John was saying about the fact that you can't remember why you made a specific decision.
Things like having a button in a specific place, or where should we or should we not show the button for privacy policy, and things that it's easy to make assumptions when you're working in a Photoshop document. And then very quickly, even though you have the flow worked out in your head, you sit down with the app, you're like, oh, wait, you're going to end up in this screen most of the time, not this other screen. And maybe we should do things a little bit differently.
So there's collaboration, even as I'm doing the sync UI. Right. It's not like they gave me the comps. I came back, it was all fully baked and everything. And then they made changes. As I'm working on that user interface, I'm showing screenshots. They have access to the code. They run builds on their devices. So they could start using it before it was even finished. And, you know, I had questions because comps don't deal with things like, well, now the keyboard's up, or it's a 3.5-inch screen, or, you know, many things that I found as I was implementing. So it's collaborative even while I'm still writing code.
Yeah, the normal thing would be to see a Glassboard post from Brent saying something like, this screen is done, here are the DB5 keys, go nuts.
I will say this too, while we're on the subject, because you asked Brent what was hard, and I think we knew it, but I think it was the right thing to do, was setting up our own account system, where the way you sign into VesperSync is you give us an email, you create a password, and you create your own account, as opposed to doing something like allowing people to use Twitter or Facebook to sign in, and or in addition to that. And we gave a lot of thought to that. And at the outset, we had been thinking maybe we'll just do Twitter and Facebook sign in. Then nobody's going to have to create a new account. They won't have to remember a new password. Seems like at least at the outset, our current user base, what percentage of people don't have either a Twitter or a Facebook account, et cetera. And it's such a stupid thing. It's not the hard part of sync. The hard part of sync is the actual sync of the data. It's like the janitorial work of just it's just stupid how many little stupid things, password reset, and what happens if somebody puts their email address in wrong, and all of these little stupid things. But I think it was the right thing to do for various reasons. But I would say it put us back at least a month, maybe more.
Oh, that's interesting. So the identity is just the basic identity layer.
Right.
Right. Cause which, you know, putting together a password reset page and the, even on the design side, the different versions of right. password reset page. And then what does that email look like and how, what's the tone of that email? And we can spend a year just working on copy for an email.
Yeah. Easily. So, yeah. Every sentence is strangled to death.
no
yeah,
word.
Well, yeah. What with you guys? Yeah.
Yeah.
Why was identity such an issue? Why did it set you back a month? Why did you not choose just to use Facebook or Twitter?
Well, you know what? We took a step back, and I know, remember Brent in particular asked his wife, Sheila, and we all started asking normal people, you know, wives and friends, and what do they think? And we realized that using something like that is solving our problem, us, QBranch, so we don't have to write our own identity system.
Right.
It's not solving their problem. And what regular people think when they see that, right or wrong, is they think, I don't want to use my Facebook login for a personal notes app because I don't trust that Facebook's not going to see my notes.
Mm.
And we know behind the scenes that the way that using Facebook as an identity thing doesn't grant Facebook read access to your notes. Yeah, we know that there is no
you get a token effectively, right?
Yeah. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what we know. It matters what they think. And they think, hey, I sign in with Facebook and I'm putting personal stuff into this notes app. Facebook sees my stuff. And then they're, you know, they just think vaguely, what if, you know, something screws up and then my notes get published to Facebook? And I think it's because in the past, there have been other things where you sign in for, you know, some service that says, hey, see your Twitter ranking, and you sign in with your Twitter, and then the stupid service posts a tweet to your account that says, I've just signed up for, you know, show my tweet score at some stupid service. And you're like, I didn't know that was going to happen.
Right. I've had a couple of times I've done something dumb and like it's tweeted out to people and I hate that.
It's so embarrassing. It's like nobody would even blame you.
Then they follow the link and it happens to them and then someone else follows the link.
Yeah, yeah. It's embarrassing is the best way to put it. It's like, look, you caught me being a dummy.
Whereas people know that if they sign in just with their email, the worst that could happen is we could send them email they didn't want to get.
Right. So why did you choose email addresses? Because A, you need to have them. They're unique, but you didn't want to have your own usernames? Like what?
Who wants to remember another thing?
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And also then we have that, you know, that's another big deal. Another bunch of UI, you know, what if I pick a username that somebody else already has, et cetera.
Yeah. Cause we're going to need to know your email address anyway, so we can confirm your account and we know where to send you reset stuff
so
and all that.
Might as well be the unique.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
I know you guys have addressed it, but just to get it on the record, Brent, iCloud, Dropbox, everyone was just saying, you know, why not just implement that and get it done immediately?
Why not just check the box?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Sure. That comes up all the time. Well, so the problem with iCloud, of course, is that if we ever wanted to do something besides Mac and iOS, say a web app, for instance, iCloud is positively no help. So we didn't want to go in limiting ourselves to, you know, a certain set of platforms. In practice, we may limit ourselves to those platforms, but we don't want to have, you know, we didn't want to have to.
And then totally going Android, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm a Java developer now.
Google Glass.
No. Oh gosh.
You laugh. It's very doubtful that Brent's going to write an Android app, but we certainly don't have any plans to do it, but it's not the most preposterous idea, right?
Yeah.
And a web app version in particular is again,
makes total sense.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not next on our list, but, I'll publicly admit it's certainly on the list as an interesting idea.
Yeah. We'll loop back to that in a bit. Sorry, Ben, why don't you continue your thought?
Let's see. Dropbox, things like that had technical limitations that made it unsuitable.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, I mean, those are good services. Simperium, and there are others. They're definitely good services. Just wouldn't have worked for us.
My argument is there's a design reason not to go with Dropbox, which is that there's no way to sign up for an account in the app. We would have to send, if you don't already have a Dropbox account, and my mom doesn't have a Dropbox account, if she wanted to sign up for Syncing Vesper, she would have to go sign up for somebody else's service first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what was your thing from, what's his name at the Omni Group?
So yeah, Tim Wood had a great tweet, very simple, own the wheel. And he was talking about Omni's syncing service, and why they use that instead of, because they could use iCloud, I suppose.
Yeah, those guys, and not Omni's.
Yeah. So yeah, when something is so incredibly integral to the success of your app, that ought to be your code. And so that's how we looked at it.
Yeah. I mean, Dropbox is a big company and it looks like they're doing a good job of staying independent, but who knows, you know, you, if we put a major, major dependence on Dropbox, and what happens if they get sold to Google
or they bring on Condoleezza Rice?
Yeah. Right. Who knows, you know, or they change their terms of service. I, you know, there's, you know, again, we did, we certainly investigated it. We definitely looked at it and we looked very hard at iCloud too. And it just, you know, but the wanting to control our own destiny in this regard is the most important thing. And if we wanted to do that eventually, I think it's a good way to never get there, to do something else first, to say, okay, we'll build our own sync system so that we can be independent and we can have a web version. We could port to Android or Windows or anything we want, or do a web app in the future. But first, let's just use iCloud sync because we can get something up first. And once you start down a path like that, all of a sudden that takes 8 months and you don't even have a line of your own code written. Like, if you know you're going to want to do something really hard, you might as well just do it. Just get started.
That's good advice. The funny thing about, so you decided to control your own destiny, so you turned to Microsoft. Right. Like, that's funny. Just like 10 years ago, that was, that just sounds awkward.
Wouldn't have made any sense at all.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. These days, it makes more and more sense. Was that a weird choice for you? I know, Brent, you'd worked with him before. Both, I know you'd done the ads, or not the ads, whatever you want to call them, the videos.
Oh, sure, yeah, the little tutorial things.
Right, but even before that, you'd worked with him for Glassboard. How much research did you guys do into that? Or was it just like, we're going with this because I know these guys?
Well, part of it was, you know, so I did those tutorials because, well, they paid me, number one, but also because I looked at the technology and I'm like, you know what? I'm surprised. This is cool stuff. And of course, at that point, I was already thinking about Vesper syncing. Right. So I had, you know, some bias because, you know, I looked at it and liked it and had a relationship with the people there. But then I did some other research. There are plenty of great cloud providers out there. Heroku and Amazon and everybody else. And I just really liked mobile services. It's kind of like training wheels for somebody who's just getting back to this or for somebody who hasn't done it before. But even though it's an easy on-ramp, it's still deep and broad and I could do everything I wanted to do and I could compose it with other services and so on. So I was, yeah, absolutely, absolutely happy with it.
I think it's like what Brent wrote about a few weeks ago is that anybody who's been in the tech industry long enough and knows that developing for Microsoft meant going Microsoft tech all the way down the stack to literally to your text editor, because it all had to run in Windows to get it to work anyway. You know, you had to be using a developer sitting in front of a Windows PC running Windows on a, you know, Intel PC, using Microsoft developer tools and Microsoft APIs and even Microsoft programming languages, connecting to Microsoft server, running Microsoft software all the way down. And it's just not like that at all with Azure and mobile services. You know, it really is the same stuff that if we wanted to switch down the road, it wouldn't be that much work to switch, because it's really just the Unix type stuff that we're used to.
I don't want to name names, but our primary contact at Microsoft carries an iPhone.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I think you also mentioned, Dave, and I'm pretty sure it's widely known that iCloud runs in large part on Azure and on some of Amazon stuff. So it's, if it's good for Apple, you know, why not Vesper?
Yeah. I mean, the question, if we want to boil it down to, we have to exclude iCloud, or iCloud doesn't fit our needs. So that's not even a choice. That's not an option. But we could ask the question, what would Apple do? And we're doing exactly what they would do. We're doing exactly what they did. Go to Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. I should add another reason for not choosing iCloud. If we wanted to build services on top, things besides just straight up syncing, again, having our own code running in the cloud makes a lot of sense. iCloud gives you nothing for that.
Right. That's a huge,
outside of the scope of iCloud. But for us, yeah, there might be things. So,
well, it also does things like in the app, when you sign up, there's a little on off for getting an email newsletter from us when we announce new products, that kind of thing. You can't do that with iCloud. We have no way to have a conversation with the customer.
Does it default to on or off?
What would you do, Guy?
I would default it to off.
Yeah, that's what we did.
I was going to say because I'm a bad businessman, but welcome to the club, kids.
Yeah. You know, app is a funny word because app is not really a technical word. And it's certainly entered the daily lexicon. You know, I don't know if it was ever the word of the year, but if not, it should have been at some point in the last 5 years because everybody knows, you know, apps now.
Yeah.
But it's not a technical term. You know, program is a technical term.
Yeah. Executable.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas the app is a little bit more fuzzy and it's a little bit more conceptual. And I think for sure that for a lot of apps nowadays, the app isn't just a program running on the device in front of the user, but it's also software running on a machine in the cloud. It's both.
It's the experience of interacting with some kind of system, right?
Yeah. Right. And so using Vesper 2.0 and every version, you know, henceforth, it still should just feel to you like you're using Vesper and app for taking notes, but it involves, an Objective-C Cocoa app running on your iPhone or eventually your Mac. And it involves code that Brent's written that's running on a server in the cloud. And you don't have to worry about that. It just all just works, but that's the app. And that's something that iCloud just doesn't even try to do, for better or for worse.
It does strike me as kind of funny, or at least vindication that the term app comes from the three letter extension that Next had for their executable bundles.
Yeah, or does the three letter extension come from what they were already calling, that's never been clear to me whether somebody came up with the bundle extension first or whether they named the bundle extension app because they were already talking about apps.
It's a real chicken egg thing. And
that's interesting.
Just in terms of the language, it's what we would do to the word anyway. It would eventually get shortened.
Right. Whereas the Windows equivalent at the same era was .exe executable.
Yeah. Or .com for DOS stuff, which was right, crazy.
For like the shared libraries or whatever.
DLL.
DLL, right.
I remember people saying the word exe out loud to refer to apps.
Exe versus app, that really tells you everything about the way Microsoft and Apple.
Exactly, that's what I loved. Like for years, people called Apple's mail program mail.app.
Right.
It's like that's just what we called it. It's mail.app.
Yeah.
People don't like it now, but it had a good 15 years of people really loving it. So,
meanwhile, Brent and I, as long-term Mac users, thought the whole thing was gross anyway, that Next even had file extensions. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Sucks.
Dummies.
I didn't run a single executable that had a file extension with a program with a file extension until Mac OS X came out.
Is that true? Yeah, you never had a DOS system?
No, never had a DOS system. I mean, I guess I had an Apple II back in the day, but I didn't even own it. It was at my school.
Yeah, but those didn't have file extensions either.
No.
Those were just like, if you want to try to execute in the image file, go ahead. I'll just explode on you. Like, it's fine.
Mm-mm. So I still think it's gross.
It is. You know what? It is gross. I've over 15 years of arguing with fucking Syracuse, I've got to the point where I'm like, yes, he's right on pretty much everything.
It's just easier to just get through life if you admit it.
Right. Well, yeah, there's that. Yeah. But it's just the degree is a little bit off. To what degree, to what degree did customer feedback make sync your major priority?
I have the support email account sorted out into folders. So whenever an email comes in from a customer, I respond and then I file it away into whatever folder it should go into. And from there, I can just look at how many emails are in each folder. Mm-hmm. And I'll do a thing with the numbers at some point once I get it all counted up. But let's say that if this is a bar graph, you're looking at pretty much like just a sliver for everything. And then the entire rest of the page is taken up by sync.
Were they actually asking for sync? Because you only have one platform that you support. And I think maybe John mentioned it at some point. Or were they asking for backup? Or was it clear what they really wanted when they say sync?
A lot of people were asking for sync specifically. I would say the vast majority. There were people, a lot of them, it would just be an email saying, hey, I was having problems with my phone. I had to take it to the Genius Bar. And they're telling me I have to wipe it. And that's the only way I can solve my problem. What do I do about my notes?
It is a rare, it's certainly not a mass market feature having iPhone to iPhone sync, but again, people who've lost their phone, taken it back. I know people at Apple and other developers, even just third party developers who switch iPhones enough that they really can't effectively use a notes app that doesn't have some kind of cloud based sync. Yeah, in the same way that you couldn't use email if it was POP instead of IMAP, because you can't just have it all on any one device.
And turns I think out Rich Siegel still does. He still runs a custom build of
Mailsmith.
Mailsmith, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. It's really custom easy for us to look at the like. It's incredibly obvious that when they say sync, what they really mean is this. But to normal people, that's all part of the same thing. That's when they say sync. Yes, of course they just mean backup. But that's what sync means to them.
Do you get the sense that? Some proportion of these people just saw that you didn't sync and wanted sync. Do you know what I mean? Like without actually having a good reason for it. It's like
maybe
it's a feature that seems like it should be baked in.
The other kind of email that we'd get that I would file under the sync folder was people who would ask for a Mac version or an iPad version or whatever. Because really it's in my mind, those are all the same question. And technically they're kind of all predicated on this one thing. And so what users really want is they want to know that they can get their notes later if they need to, and they want to know they can get to their notes from wherever they want to get to their notes from.
So that's an interesting notion to me because the idea that supporting other platforms is predicated upon having sync is a relatively modern idea, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Like it used to be that like, well, you know, I can buy Microsoft Word on my Mac or I can buy it on my PC, and sync was just, that was the last thing anybody ever thought about.
We sometimes get the question, like, I know you guys are working on sync, but why don't you put a Mac app out first?
Answer. it's an interesting question. I think there's a good rationale behind it, but yeah, let's hear that.
The answer is simply that the best way to make that useful is to make your notes available, the same group of notes in both places. Sure. And it's interesting that people there, just off of what you said, maybe you're right. There's two schools of thought here. One is that people are thinking of Vesper as the idea and the collection of the notes and how they get to those notes. An app as a technical term means something different than maybe than what we think it means. And maybe it's just some old school people on the other side who are like, well, yeah, but I just really want to write notes here and there. And I don't care if they connect together.
Right. At this point, I expect them to connect together. I want to type a note. Like I want to basically copy and paste something like an ingredients list out of a recipe in my web browser on my Mac into a notes app and have it sync to my phone. And they go shopping, which is a horrible way to – it's the worst to-do list ever, but that's what I do often. Sometimes I just take photographs, which is also dumb. But
I do the same exact things.
Yeah. Sometimes when I go shopping, I'll take a photograph of my empty fridge. Just like, oh, yeah, look, I need some orange juice because there's no orange juice here.
You could just have one picture of your empty fridge.
I guess so.
I just reuse that.
That, yeah. That's why I'm a dummy.
I'll tell you what I think of it, and it's a great quote. It's, I don't know when he said it. I just Googled it, and it doesn't have a year. But it's a quote from Bill Gates, and I think he was talking about the tech industry in particular. But he says, we always overestimate the change that will occur in the next 2 years and underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. Don't let yourself be lulled into inaction.
Right.
And I think that's so true. It's true when you're talking about a big company like Apple, but it's true even for a small developer like us. Like it's easy to overestimate how much we can get done quickly. And just, you know, that word just use Dropbox or just use iCloud. And then you can just, you know, hurry up, make a Mac version and just have them sync. And there's nothing there. And so it's so easy to think you can get all this stuff together quickly. And then you can't. You have to do one thing at a time. You have to make a really good, slick, well-designed iPhone app first. And then you have to, you know, do 8 months of really hard work on a sync system that's built for the future. And then you have to do these other things. But then, you know, it's easy to under, you know, I'm pretty confident that, you know, 2-3 years from now, when Vesper is a more complete system and has clients on numerous, you know, areas and everybody's been using it for a long time, it'll be hard to remember what it was like when you didn't just have Vesper everywhere and your notes from the last 2-3-4 years, you know, at your fingertips.
I love that you quote Bill Gates.
Well, that's a great line. I really think and everybody, and it's, you know, it's just like the nature of technology, because it's a focused on what's new,
right,
that we always, you know, it's what's next. What's the next iPhone? The iPhone 6. And we're just so super, super focused on the iPhone, you know, that's coming in 3 or 4 months, and never really think about the, you know, the fact of that there's always going to be a new one. And 2-3-4 years from now, what does that mean?
Right. And you know, Microsoft succeeded mostly, I think, because of their initial statement of mission, which is like, we're going to just put a computer everywhere. I think they kind of faltered a little bit after that. But the notion of having a guiding ideal is powerful, I think, or at least it can be if you stick to it. Beyond just making an iOS app, you've alluded to getting onto other platforms. One of them was doing a web app. You've mentioned a Mac app. I'm not going to ask you to actually give away any candy.
Why not?
Well, okay. If you want to give away candy, give away candy. But don't make me feel like I'm holding your feet to the fire here. How do you sort of balance those kind of decisions? Like what's the... you know, the pros and cons list look like in terms of what platform you're going to hit next and why?
That's an interesting way to ask that.
Well, because I almost don't, I mean, I do care personally, but I don't actually care what platform you pick next. I want to know why you picked it.
Well, we're being public about where we're going next, right? So I think we can say that we're doing a Mac app. And
did I miss that?
We're being public, but we haven't written it yet because we're waiting for the iPhone app to come out.
Okay. I'd caught you saying it. I just didn't know if you wanted it.
Our unofficial policy.
Underscored, right.
Unofficial company policy is if we feel like there's a good reason to do it, we'll commit to one next thing at a time. And so we're not going to say what's going to come after the Mac version, but we're, you know, in the same way that back in September, we said sync. Next big thing we're going to do is sync. Now May 2014, we're willing to say next big thing we're going to do is a Mac client.
Cool. Okay. So that's news to me. So
why?
Why? Right. Nobody has an app.
I have selfish reasons, which is that I love writing Mac apps so damn much. And, you know, I'm just so excited to do it. I mean,
the Mac is fun to work on.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. And, you know, I've been a Mac developer for so long. I love it so much. And it's been like 3 years since I've done a Mac app, which is crazy. That's just wrong because it's my natural home.
Right.
I think it's all selfish reasons, but they're all good selfish reasons. For Brent, that's his wheelhouse. That's where he's from. And it's going to be a great transition back for him, for John using Mac stuff and thinking about Mac stuff for years. There's an obvious connection there. For me, most of my career has been spent doing iOS. And John once said early on when we were doing sketches for a Mac app, he said that I speak Mac with a very thick iOS accent. And now that we're expecting 10.10 to have some big UI changes more in the direction of iOS, it's going to be interesting to see how those ideologies converge. And that'll be, I think it's going to be a really fun, interesting, big challenge for us.
Yeah, no, I think that whatever changes they do will, it's going to change the way we all think about Mac software. Assuming it's, I don't even know how big of a change it can be, but I don't want to get into speculation.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. And I know that it's leaked to some degree, but I think it's leaked even less than the iOS 7 stuff a year ago. I feel we are now with 10.10 imminent, you know, we're like, I think we're literally 10 days out, or 10, as we record. I feel like, you know, all anybody really has is the vague notion that it's sort of iOS 70 direction, which is sort of a big duh, you know.
Right. Yeah. But it's so vague. It's like you can't put your finger on it. Like before iOS 7, I was having random designers just eyeing me being like, holy shit, I'm pissed off. In some way, like that, like word had gotten out that flat was being a thing, and yeah, people like gradients felt all butthurt. But whatever.
Yeah, so there are people who live and die by that.
There's such a thing as idioms in UI design, just like in language. And to me, and I think Brent too, idiomatic Mac design comes in a way that I don't even really have to think about it. It's I'm the same way when I write. Like I'm very, very, in terms of like being able to teach the English language, I'm terrible. I really don't even know what parts of speech a lot of words are. It just comes to me. Mm-hmm. Even though I probably write at a relatively, you know, fluent grade level. I don't understand it. I couldn't in the same way that I probably would be a terrible person to write a UI guidelines for the Mac because I understand them at an intuitive level as opposed to an intellectual level. So I'm interested to see how much that changes when they unveil 10.10 because if it's just the look, then that's it doesn't matter. And if it's at a deeper level, those changes will stick out to me immediately as foreign, not necessarily bad. I'll keep an open mind, but they'll jump out to me immediately.
Yeah, I agree. I think I speak Mac first in terms of design aesthetics. Aesthetics is the wrong word. Sort of design language. The fact that you can sort of pull down a menu and hold your mouse button down and pick an item. And the way that, like, if the menu has a sub menu, you can glide at a 45 degree angle to get to the other menu without having to break. You know what I mean? It doesn't break the connection.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That stuff, that's the way the Mac works. iOS, I still haven't, despite it being out for years now, I still haven't quite figured out what is iOS yet.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Here's an example is and you can see examples of both of what I'm going to say, but let's say you have an email address and a password to sign into a service and there's two fields. Okay. On the iPhone, you do know one thing. Everybody knows you stack them one on top of each other and you put the labels in the field and it'll say email and then underneath that password and you tap next to where it says email and you type it in. But where does the button go for what you do next? Is it the button on the keyboard? Down in the lower right that says done, you press that and that makes you go forward. Is it a button underneath the text fields or is it up in the top in the nav bar, like up in the top left, there's one that says cancel and in the top right, there's one that says next.
Right.
You can find apps that do all three.
Yeah.
Not one app that does all three. You can find three apps that do it each of those ways and you have to decide. And, you know, and in some cases, they're from the same developer. There's Apple apps that do it both ways. You know, like a lot of the things you do in the settings app, like when you sign up for an iCloud account or add a new email, they use that next button up in the top right of the screen. And in other apps, you know, they don't. They put a button down there. Whereas on the Mac, it's obvious. It's two text fields, and in the lower right of wherever those text fields are, there's a button that tells you to keep going.
So I agree. And I think the interesting thing with iOS, as distinct from the Mac, is that there are three ways of doing exactly that. And I don't think there's necessarily a wrong way. Do you know what I mean? You don't get that gut reaction of like, "Ee, this is just wrong." Like, it's not like they flip the OK and cancel buttons in, right. in dialogue. Like, it's just they're equally valid solutions.
And some of that is the age of the platform, and some of that is the age of the technology. But I think most importantly, it's this: we're still sort of figuring out what's best, and it's nice as a designer to live in a world where what's best can be idiomatic to the app rather than like a platform convention. There are design patterns, of course, that work overall, but sometimes the thing that you want to accomplish can inform where the button goes rather than convention.
Sure.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. But I agree and disagree with you in sort of equal measures there is that, iOS actually has been around for a long time. I think iOS now is as old as classic macOS was when they rebooted it. With the next purchase.
No. Because that was 84 to 97. And the next...
It's as old as OS 10 was when iOS came out.
Yes, that's a good... Yeah. That's what you're thinking, and that's exactly right. And that is, to me, kind of mind-bending.
Yeah.
But iOS is as old today, 7 years, as OS 10 was when... it's even older, really.
Yeah.
If you don't count the betas of... Mac OS 10, weird
March 24th, 2001 was
Kodiak.
Release dated.
Right.
Kodiak,
so it was only 6 years old when the iPhone debuted, which is crazy. And now the iPhone is 7 years old.
And when I say the platform, I don't necessarily mean iOS. I mean like
multi-touch screens. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. In that OS 10 had, you know, not necessarily the software heritage, like
right, but you understand what a file is, what a folder is, heritage.
Right? Yeah, and in fact, during the early OS 10 period, I'm sure John and Brent remember, there was a lot of concern that some of the old Mac stuff won't be coming forward. That thing that I mentioned earlier with the menus wasn't there. I think that. There was a lot of small little UI affordances that the Next didn't have, or OpenStep didn't have, that OS X had to sort of adopt and pull forward. But 7 years is a long time, and you'd think that there would be some kind of a consistency at this point.
Well, you know, that's funny that you would say that word, consistency, because that we used to throw that around a lot. Those of us who critiqued and analyzed and reviewed Mac software. Mm-hmm. And consistency was always supposed to be a hallmark of good Mac design. But it was more
like, did you adhere to the HIG or not? Now, and we're going to hit you with a stick in some weird way.
And it's a tricky word because there's a lot of different aspects to consistency. And I've written about it even before iOS, but I kind of had like remember the whole, what they call it, the delicious generation thing.
Yeah.
You know, with apps that went exuberant in a visually expressive style, you know, let's just, you know, in broad terms, a lot more design work happening in Photoshop than in Interface Builder.
Right.
And was that good or bad? Well, it's certainly, whatever you think of it, it certainly presaged an awful lot of the original iOS look. You know, the iOS 1 to 6 look was presaged by that delicious generation trend on Mac design. You know, and you know, specifically, the, you know, like maybe the poster child would be, and that's where the delicious and delicious generation comes from, delicious library with these richly detailed wooden shelves where your media products showed up and lighting effects on the DVD covers and all this stuff.
Mike Madison, you know, sort of really kicked off a big deal there.
Right. And obviously Shipley in terms of implementing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's you, John, I think had said, you were talking about the way screens have affected this. And I would say that that type of UI came along at a point in history when we had displays that were capable of showing off a really great wood texture. And now we have displays that you kind of forget with the Retina display. You're not thinking about anything will look good. You can put just text on there and that's going to look fine. You don't have to dress it up.
Yeah, that is a good point. Where those things came along when the displays were capable of showing a nice wood texture and lighting effects, but they weren't yet at the point where they could actually render text well. Plain text that they, you know, there still wasn't enough resolution to make text look, it still looked fuzzy when you anti-aliased it. You really needed to make the Retina jump to get just to make the text look good.
Yeah, I don't know that we could have made Vesper 5 years ago. It would be dramatically different, is what I mean. Right.
But the word that I came up with,
and it'd be brush metal.
No,
it's an aspect of consistency is uniformity. Mm-hmm. And I've years ago, I think I even gave a talk about it, but just think about that word and what it means. Like if you have a job where you wear a uniform and it could be something, you know, there's positive and negative connotations to it. You know, you could be working at McDonald's and it's sort of menial labor and everybody has to wear a crummy uniform. Right. But in other cases, people are really proud to wear a uniform. People who are in the army, a firefighter.
That's armor. That's awesome.
Right. Or in the armed services or you're on a sports team, you know, sure. It's something you want to put on. And to a certain other degree, there's a uniformity to the way you dress if you are in certain companies, like if you're an attorney and you wear a nice suit and you're expected to have a certain appearance. It's not quite a uniform in terms of, wearing an identical suit, but it's, you know, there's a uniformity to it. And the Mac to me has always been a platform that encourages uniformity. And that's what some of us objected to or were put off by with the delicious generation thing is that they didn't seem to fit in with the rest of the system. They prided themselves on individuality, rather than you know, just wear the suit.
Right.
And for guys like me, my objection to that look is it felt like we got to a place, especially on the iPhone, a year or year and a half ago, we'd reached a place where it seemed like designers were putting more emphasis on the way things looked than any other part of the design. And I would hear, when I was doing client work, I would hear people all the time talking about visual design and saying things like, well, we'll just get a visual designer off of Dribbble. Like, well, if you're just choosing somebody off of Dribbble, you're not really choosing a designer. You're choosing, right. I mean, that's one part of somebody's thought process. That's one part of their work. And the fact there was so much emphasis on just the visuals, I may have even hurt us.
Right. So, okay. Dave, you're a little bit younger than us.
I'm not that much younger than you.
Not that much younger, but enough that I think this may be an interesting point. And I know you came to the Mac, like I count myself as coming to the Mac late and I came to it in like 97.
Yeah, I got my first Mac at the beginning of 2005.
Gross. Okay. Right. Gross.
Wow.
I'm curious.
I just got fired.
Did you notice this delicious generation stuff? Like, was this news for you? I know that Brent, John and I were like, okay, this is a big thing and stuff is happening. Was it something that you picked up on as a user?
Oh, absolutely.
It was relatively new to the platform. Okay.
But it was, it affected me in a different way. I mean, coming from Windows and Linux, the short version is that I'd been using Windows since I was like Windows 3.1.1 since I was like 13 years old and, Linux since shortly after that. I was a Linux administrator, Unix administrator for a while. So for me, going to the Mac was as if the only TV I'd ever seen were black and white. And suddenly I'm given a color television. So all of this bright, vibrant color, delicious generation stuff was a new world for me. It was seeing things in a way that I'd never seen before. It was Technicolor.
Did that change the way you thought about software?
It made me think of software as art for the first time. Which is not quite the right metaphor, but it made me see that there's a creative value here. It's not just about solving problems technically. It's not how do I make it to where I don't have to spend the whole day recompiling my kernel because of some library. Like it made it about the things that I was using my computer to accomplish rather than accomplishing things on my computer. And it was a real, like, there's a lot of stuff that goes up, but there's a, like, a switch that got flipped in my head. And I'm like, wait, there's a whole other thing going on here with this tech that I hadn't even thought about.
Right. You actually can be joyful or playful, at least in your.
Right. Like, my career up until that point had been working on computers. And now my career since then has been using computers to do my job, which is something sort of.
Yeah, it's a subtle but distinct difference, right?
Right, right. Yeah. I don't feel the need to have my hands inside the guts of a PC tower anymore. I'm not like checking Newegg to see what the prices are and the new video card. I don't think about that stuff anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. After I started buying Macs, I stopped buying motherboards and yeah. sticking random crap together. So Brent, how did that kind of change affect you? Because I think you still had NetNewsWire at the time. I think you hadn't even got rid of Mars Edit yet.
Gotten rid of.
Yeah. Well, you know what I mean.
Passed it off on that poor.
Passed it on to the garbage can that is gel-cut.
Good for Daniel for avoiding both the delicious look and the entire iOS revolution. I'm just teasing him. I love Daniel. I love what he's done with Mars Edit. Yeah. It's fantastic. It found a perfect home.
You would design, like, that was back in the days when, like, Mac, or at least there was a period where a lot of developers were like one-man shops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or one-person shops, I should say, but practically speaking, skew male. Did you look at that and be like, I can't design this and develop this. I can't keep up with this kind of trend. Or did you just kind of reject the notion out of hand?
Well, so there was, even without the whole delicious thing, there was a general trend where Mac apps looked better and better, you know, as time went on. And Apple, I think, was leading the way an awful lot with their iLife suite. So it just meant that, you know, my app had to keep evolving and keep looking better and better. I didn't think to myself that the only way to remain successful would be to, you know, have smoke particles coming out of my RSS reader. But I did think, well,
it has, do you know, to what? I admit that. So that was Jason Harris. And
yeah.
We emailed a little bit. Like, I might have told him how to do that.
Good. I mean,
he did it all, but we threw ideas back and forth.
You're welcome, world.
No question. You know, that was an awesome effect, and things like that are fun and cool. But I didn't think that if I don't do this, I'm sunk. Right. I just had to, you know, keep doing the job I do just to make it better. And I did do some things, like one of the interesting points I recall was when I got rid of the margins around the split view.
Yep.
So that the source list went all the way to the left. And this was one of the very first apps outside of Apple to adopt that look.
And so it was at a time, this is key, it was at a time when the Higgs still said put a border.
Yes. Yeah, it even told you how many pixels. Yeah, I mean, so I was always looking to the future and looking at the trends, looking at what's happening, watching what Apple's doing, and trying to, you know, be ahead of the curve, but without having to do, you know, crazy gradients or particle effects.
Right, some kind of app, so.
This is one of those, the G and Higgs stands for guideline things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, at one point it felt like it almost stood for gospel. And then if you went against the Higg, you were kind of, your app was broken.
Well, I would say this. I think that the guidelines thing is it's good that Dave's a designer, because that encourages him to think he can break them. But I think it's more, you know, is the Higg, it's like the argument in language, and when, you know, people make new uses of new words and stuff like that, prescriptivism versus descriptivism. Is the purpose of the dictionary to prescribe how we use words, or is it to describe how words are being used? And the truth is, the Higg has always been, or at least in the modern era, after the 80s, you know, at some point in the 90s, it became descriptive, which is that the actual software that Apple and leading third parties are making is defining the look and feel of the platform. And the Higg's job is to describe that for developers as a reference, just to double check stuff, not that the new stuff is going to come in the HIG first and then filter out into software. And there's always going to be a contingent of people who want the HIG to be prescriptive. And if Apple wants stuff to change, they should change the HIG first and then have us build the software to follow. But it's never going to work that way.
Yeah, I think it's a smaller and smaller percentage of developers. So, sorry, Dave, go ahead.
I think that language is a great analogy there, because just like with language, I would say the people who should be doing things that break the HIG or violate the HIG or whatever word you want to use there, that go against the HIG, it should be done informedly. It should be people who understand the HIG. Like, you shouldn't just go wildly guessing and throw things to the wall until something works. Like, know your platform, know your language before you start trying to change it.
Well, I think one thing that helps is that early on during Mac development, you basically had to code pretty much everything. These days, the frameworks take care of a lot of it for you. So a lot of the basic plumbing, even if you've got smoke particles coming out the top of your window, at least a lot of the basic plumbing is implicit just from the frameworks. So maybe that makes the HIG less valuable in the prescriptive way, and as John was saying, it's better to describe the best practices effectively. So maybe that's where we've landed now. Recently, Apple put out on iBooks the iOS 7 HIG. How does that document inform the way you make decisions about Vesper?
At least for the last year or 2 years, has been more of like a cheat sheet than anything else. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm stuck on something, that's when I go back to it. Like, well, what do they say that you should do here? But even then, I find myself looking at other apps more than I look at the HIG.
Do you ever go to any of those design patterns, UI design patterns websites?
Yeah, especially for the account stuff that we were working on.
Mm-hmm.
Like how are people stacking these things? What's the best practice? And there's a couple of things where we went maybe a little outside the box, and there may be some controversy, but
really?
Well, in the create account that we only ask for a password once.
Oh, sure. And we have the show and hide button.
Yeah. I think those, if there's a controversy to be had there, it's going to be with that.
Yeah. In that you may end up getting a whole bunch of password reset requests.
Yeah.
You know, we did the same thing with Glassboard and it was fine.
Yeah. I always wonder because, you know, typically it's like enter your password twice to make sure you're not typing like a dummy password or like you don't have a typo.
The thing that occurs to me that stinks is that the right way to do that is because the phone almost certainly, I would guess 99.9% of the time, when Vespers run, there's already a configured email account on the device. And so in theory, we should be able to say, what are the user's email accounts and let them pick from them.
Right?
Yeah. Well, of course it is, because there's, if apps could ask for the user's email accounts, there's, you know, to present them a list, there's nothing that would stop the app from, instead of showing it in a list, just sending it, you know, phoning at home. So of course the app doesn't have access to that because people would abuse it. But if Apple could magically trust everybody not to abuse it, we could foolproof, you know, it would be foolproof that you wouldn't have a typo in your email account because we would just show you a list of the ones you've already configured on the phone.
Right.
I think the worst case scenario that you could have creating an account right now is if you have a typo in your email account and then you enter a password and you hit okay and you create this account. And now you've got a sync account with an email address that you can't actually address or access.
Yeah, that'd stink.
Yeah, but then you just create another account. And
right.
You're fine. Yeah.
Right. So it's not like you can recover from it, but it's that, you know, it's not a bad worst case. But
I think you can scan the contacts and check for the email, but you're still going to need that. That dialogue's going to pop up in your face.
Right. Is there a way to say what's the me card to ask for the?
Well, there's a secret way, and if you do it, they get upset. Chris Parrish did it for postage, and he had to pull it at Apple's request. So.
Right. Yeah. There you go. And of course, you know, it would be really weird if when you are signing up for an account, if you first had to say Vesper would like to access your contacts, yes or no.
Yeah, that's Yeah. Too creepy. I hate the way you can't customize those dialogues. And I understand why, but it's...
Yeah, I don't like that either.
There's a cool trend now where I'm seeing apps that on first launch, they'll open up and they'll say, hey, here's the stuff we're about to ask you for. Here's why. Are you cool with that? And if you say yes, then they start throwing those dialogues at you.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, it's not perfect, but it's
better than the other way, for sure.
It's a great way to work within the limitation.
No, but there needs to be a better thing. Like a sheet where you can just at least check off everything at once.
Yeah, rather than going through a series of those alerts and doing cancel okay, cancel okay.
Right. And an alert is, guess what? It's alerting. It's like, this is in my face and like I'm kind of alarmed by it, which is the intention of it. So good job with that. But it's, you know, it intentionally takes away from the joy of using the application itself, I think. Why didn't you do the web first? John, earlier you said you'd consider the web client. Doesn't that make more sense in terms of expanding your audience? Just stick it on the web and you can get Vesper everywhere.
You mean first in terms of before we even did the iPhone or first?
Before the Mac. Given that you've got the iPhone just because you wanted a native iPhone app, and it makes sense there. The next step to me might have been the web, because you can address Windows and whatever the hell Unix is going on and the Mac in one fell swoop.
Well, I would say twofold. A, we don't want it next ourselves. I'd rather have a Mac app than a web app. And, you know, as one example, daily use, daily part of our workflow is Glassboard. Glassboard right now runs on the iPhone and runs on the web. And might have been the right, I'm not second questioning why Glassboard doesn't have a Mac native app but has a web one. But me personally, I sure wish that it did. I would trade Glassboard web for a Glassboard Mac client in a second. Selfishly, I'd rather have Vesper on Mac than Vesper on web. And then to put on my CEO hat for a second, we can charge money for a Mac app, and you could charge for an account or something on a web app, but it's a lot trickier.
Yeah, it gets muddy, especially if it's web and iPhone, your ability to charge for both gets weird.
That's a good point I hadn't considered.
I'd also add that we have Mac app expertise in house and we don't have web app expertise.
So that's kind of where my question was heading. Was it, do you guys feel capable of doing a web app?
Well, as capable as we were of doing online web services. Yeah, there may be a learning curve. And but of course, yeah, we can.
I might want to clean up my HTML, CSS style. But other than that.
Yeah, do you have a lot of web experience, Dave?
I'm very duct tape it together until it works and then, you know, walk away smiling. I'm not as meticulous. When it comes to, like, if I'm working out an icon or something, I get down to the pixel. I'm obsessive. But if it's CSS, the second it looks right, I walk away before it all falls apart.
Yeah, John, I know you worked at Joyent back in the day doing design on, like, pretty featureful applications. Yeah.
Web, all web.
Well, all web stuff, right. Have you kept up with that? Like, would you feel comfortable doing a web thing?
Oh, I think so.
Cocky bastard.
Well, I guess the big question still is, even to this day, is how much do you make a web app that, you know, clearly the problem scope here, it's not just a generic web app. It's a specific one, a web app that would let you create and sync your Vesper notes and photos. How much do you make that look like a native app as opposed to going in a more webby direction? That's, right. You know, there's certainly some questions there that I don't know the answer to, you know, and do you do things like do it all dynamically where it's all like JavaScript, and the URL doesn't change as you click stuff, or do you, you know, when you click a note, you go to a URL just for that note. And then you go back to a URL that's just for a list. There's like questions that I haven't even given a lot of thought to.
And then responsive design and what looks good in what browser sizes.
Right. Yeah. Do you worry about that? Because we have an iPhone app. So why would we worry about a dynamic, you know, a responsive version of it, you know?
Because some people have other kinds of phones.
Exactly. But do we care? You know, well, seriously, because we're not making money from them, right? True, we make money, you know, the economics. Right, unless we are. So there's a lot of questions there.
This is what all of our conversations are like.
Right. Apple seems to have gone in a very, with the iCloud, iWork apps, you know, in a very make them look like the desktop apps direction. Right. I mean, I don't, you know, I think that's just self-evident by looking at them.
Yeah.
If whether that's the way we would go, I honestly don't even know. I haven't given a lot of thought. Possibility, but I don't know.
So that leaves us with iPad.
Yeah, iPad.
Why not left for the iPad?
It runs on the iPad. You can put iPhone apps on an iPad.
And it'll sync to it soon too.
All right.
Yeah, here's
you can just say no comment.
Here's my thinking on that. My thinking on that is largely informed or clarified over just the last few weeks as internally we've had sync up and running and working, where I can run Vesper on my Mac now because I can do a build and run in Xcode and have it run in the simulator on my Mac. And it's actually changed the way I use Vesper, because I actually use Vesper on my Mac that way, because I have a crazy URL and or, you know, like a YouTube URL, which isn't necessarily long, but which is, you know,
it's gobbledygook YouTube, you can.
Yeah, it's gobbledygook that you can't just type. And I know I want to watch it late. I don't want to watch it now. I want to watch it later tonight. And so I'll copy it and I'll go to Vesper running in the simulator on my Mac, type in what it is, paste the URL, which is crazy because to paste into the simulator, you have to do like a command V just to give it to the simulator and then simulate the way you paste in iOS by clicking in there and getting the little pop-up and then tapping the paste button. But at least it's there. And then the next time I open Vesper on my iPhone late at night, you know, having a cold one, there's the Apple TV. There it is at the top of my Vesper list, and I can tap it and AirPlay it to my TV, and it's right there. And it's, to me, it's super great. And it's something I never did before. We had it running on the Mac. I wouldn't have that URL in Vesper. I'd have to do it some other way. And it's really convenient. And just having Vesper running in a convoluted way on my Mac, really just shows me that I want
to change the experience, right?
Right. Yeah. And you can get that right now, that same convoluted, definitely not ideal, not perfect, but you can get that on your iPad now by running once it's in the App Store, you can run the iPhone version on your iPad. And no, it's definitely not ideal. And I wouldn't tell anybody that that's our solution to running Vesper on your iPad, but it is there.
Mm-hmm. It's far more possible for other users who aren't us to run it on their iPad than it is to run it on their Mac.
Right. It is. Right. It's not great, but it's way, way better than nothing. Whereas what we have right now on the Mac is nothing other than for those of us who can run the simulator builds.
Yeah. So, no, I was just mostly curious about why you went for the Mac rather than the iPad. And this is coming from a guy, like my company's app only exists on the Mac. Because I think it's a good platform. I think you can charge real money for it. And I think that's where the work gets done. For at least what we want to, like the, you know, the problem we want to solve.
And it sounds like a selfish thing, but it's part of our long-term thinking. It's when we sat down to do sync, when Brent sat down to do sync, that it was with the knowledge this is going to be, if not the most challenging thing in front of us, the biggest, most daunting, most challenging thing. It's number two. It's, I don't even know what number one would even be at this point. And the Mac app versus iPad, the amount of effort and design attention and development attention that'll have to go into making a Mac app versus an iPad app is just dramatically bigger. And I think it's about wanting to get some of these big things out of the way so that we can pick up the small stuff. And I don't mean to say that iPad is small. In fact, I almost wonder if the assumption is that it's going to be easy because, well, we can just, you know, make it, put on a bigger screen. But even then, there's going to be things that we're going to want to change. And I think it's going to end up being more different than even we expect.
So you think that the Mac thing is like a bigger leap than just bringing it to the iPad?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. I mean, again, our assumptions change, and as we get closer to things, they become clearer, more focused. But just looking at it on the face of it today, I would guess that it's going to take way more work to get a Mac app than it is to get an iPad app. But I think that the delta between the two may not be as big as we would expect.
Did you guys give, because you've mentioned it a couple times, thought about whether you're charging for clients or charging for a service? You know, for example, Office for iPad launched and it's free, but you've got to have an Office 365 subscription. Did you give thought to whether Vesper should be a sync service you subscribe to and then the clients are free or vice versa?
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much thought.
We're still not sure. There's so many endless discussions about this.
Well, there's trade-offs, right? Because if you're charging for the sync service, then the clients don't really matter. You can put them anywhere and everywhere without regard to whether you're getting paid for them or not. But, you know, charging for sync services hasn't always been the best business model for every company.
Right. And as Brent pointed out, cloud services are trending toward free. And it's hard to think. I don't know. I would rather live in a world, if I have to choose one, I'd rather live in a world where we charge for software than a world where we charge for services.
It puts our focus on making the app, the thing the user interacts with, the great thing, right? If that's what we're charging for. And the service is just a feature of that.
Which means by definition, the service has to work well. Rather than putting all of the attention on the service and not really caring as much about the app, focusing on the app becomes focusing on the service as a feature.
It feels like it's more aligned with my interest as a user.
Right. It doesn't feel like there's as much of a trade-off. If what I care about is how things feel when somebody's using the app, I'm always going to feel better thinking those terms than I am in thinking of how do we get more subscribers.
Right. Never say never, but that's our vague hope. And looking at the trends of what these online services cost, it is our, you know, loosely held plan to charge for apps and provide service as part of using the apps. Hmm.
Do you think that'll be tenable? But, I mean, obviously you do, or else you wouldn't.
Well, I'll even go back. You know, the big question
in terms of recurring costs year over year, right?
Like right.
10 years out, what happens?
Exactly. Go back to that Bill Gates quote about, you know, 2 years versus 10 years, and what happens 10 years from now when people are still using Vesper, but they're, you know, they haven't upgraded in a while, and how much is it costing us? So we don't know, you know, we'll have to see, and maybe it'll have to change. And it could be, you know, if you're talking about thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of users, or, you know, even, you know, wouldn't it be great? Hundreds of thousands of users, you know, you can start to think about things like the fact that something like $1.99 for an annual sync account, not monthly, but like annual, and $1.99 might make a huge difference to a small company in terms of its, you know, the financial viability of it. And, you know, it's hopefully at a level where you'd get you wouldn't see a large drop off in people, you know, saying, I'm not paying $1.99 a year. That's, you know, that's going to bankrupt me. But on the other hand, you know, if you can do it for only $1.99, maybe you can just give it away for free. I don't know. We'll have to see. We just don't know at this point.
Yeah. It's certainly to our advantage that the big cloud players are competing heavily with each other, including on price.
Right.
And I expect prices to keep going down.
Right. That's the other long-term thing in terms of, yes, maybe long-term we're no longer getting as, you know, recurring money from these existing companies, but in the meantime, Microsoft and Amazon and these other companies continue to provide more and more bandwidth and more CPU and more RAM at lower and lower prices.
Yeah, you guys get more bang for your buck, so it all evens out.
We're in a really good position for that trend because, like, where I wouldn't want to be is a small company, where Heroku was a few years ago when they were new. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be them now, you know, a three, four, five person startup providing cloud services to developers in the face of these fantastic, truly fantastic offerings from Amazon and Microsoft and, you know, now, you know, Heroku and Rackspace and these big companies. We're on the right side of that. Being developers who just want to use these services, that trend of providing truly you know, and you just think back to what bandwidth used to cost and what it used to cost just to have a single CPU server running in a, you know, in a professional data center. It's just silly what you get for your money now.
Yeah. I think Marco was tweeting earlier this week, that he was really happily surprised about how little money he was paying for the Overcast backend setup.
Right. And that's just compared to, you know, like Instapaper, which isn't that old. You know, Instapaper was 2008, 2009. I mean, yeah. It's not.
And
even
there was
that
a magazine, old. Which I think.
Right.
I forget it just, what year it, that was.
Yeah. It's really moving. It's just one of those areas where the whole industry is still moving at a crazy Moore's Law type, hey, come back in 18 months and it's a new landscape pace.
Right. Yeah. So I definitely think as client side people, we're on the good end of this.
Yeah. I'm curious about what
I think it could be a problem at one point, but
yeah. I'm curious about what Apple's going to do, because I feel like it's one of those things where Apple's offerings, people grumbled when iCloud came out and they charged what they charged. At this point, 2014, I think what they're charging for iCloud looks exorbitant. Mm-hmm. I forget what the cost per
100 bucks for 50 gigs.
Yes. Yeah, 100 bucks for 50 gigs for people
that's
who've already
crazy.
Spent. Yeah, it's crazy.
I've seen what Azure charges. That's a lot of money. There's a lot of profit there.
Well, I think it's supposed to disincentivize people from using it.
Sure. Yeah. Wonderful.
I know nothing. I am not breaking any kind of rumors here. I mean, you know, the cloak of secrecy is very well in effect, at least as far as I'm concerned around WWDC. But I wouldn't be surprised, just common sense wise, if they can make an announcement that iCloud prices are changing dramatically. And if they don't, I think they're overlooking the trend.
It should at least be enough. You should get enough at the bare minimum to do a backups of your phone and your iPad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like every device that you have, whatever storage capacity it should have, you should get equal amount of iCloud carved out for you.
Right. Yes. This disk space isn't even the expensive part.
Yeah, but it feels like they could do that without being kind of crazy. Also, reliability would be nice. Yeah. Most of it actually works. It's just more the document syncing has been problematic. The code side, the client side, code side stuff is not great.
Would you want more developer access into iCloud, either Guy or Brent? Developer APIs or anything like that, or the ability to do more of your own stuff?
In terms of like what Brent does, which is basically write server side code. I think it's interesting, but there are other providers out there, as you know, KubeBranch is showing. I don't think I need that much. Even for Napkin, we use Heroku for that kind of thing. I don't think it's Apple's forte, and I don't know if they would do a great job. So I'm not clamoring for them to do it. I like the way that they do closed systems well, as long as they do them well, which they haven't been doing in with a lot of iCloud stuff. So I don't know what your thoughts are, Brent.
Well, so the best thing about iCloud is that you don't have to create an account. I mean, well, you've created an iCloud account, but then for each app that uses iCloud, you don't have to create another account. And it would be really great if there was some secure API for somehow tying into that. So people came to Vesper, they have an iCloud account. It's fine. We still run our own web services, but we've got some kind of identity token.
Yeah, I would
something.
Love that. Like Apple giving me a token to the user. Yeah. Oh, God,
that would have been great. That
it's
exactly,
like a single thing. If it can do that, I'm sold.
That would be huge, I think. Is it, and that would have been one where I would have, I think it would have solved all the problems that we had thinking about using Twitter or Facebook. People shouldn't be worried about that. And we could do a thing eventually where maybe if they want to, they could sign up with their own email. But as a first version, just make, you know, saying use your iCloud just as to identify yourself. Boy, that would be great.
Yeah. Then we create a couple of new problems. So one nice thing about the way it works today is we've got your email address and you have an account that you can use. If there is a web app or an Android app or a Google Glass app, you're not having to link it somehow. Because if you signed up, let's say there were a Google Glass app and you sign up with your iPhone today using your Apple ID, and then you go pick up your Google Glass, how do you sign in? How do you get to your data?
What's we'd have to work that out somehow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm saying there's an upside to it.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, the other upside is the sort of Amazon upside, right? Where you want the customer's information more than you care about a smooth experience.
Right.
The Comixology move.
Yeah. The other thing that I could see, and I could see it being, you know, you have to always ask yourself, what's in it for Apple? So why would Apple want to provide something like that? And the thing that it would provide is it would provide a little bit more lock-in, where if we were using, if our first version of Vesper used this iCloud tokens for identity, then, you know, we'd still have to do something else for the eventual web app, probably. Or maybe not. Maybe there'd be like an API and even a web app could let you do it. But
that'd be cool.
But it would certainly keep you, you know, it would keep you in the Apple ecosystem as a user. Even if the app isn't using the iCloud services for data sync.
So one thing I found fascinating, this is getting into talk show territory, but one thing I found fascinating about those slides that came out of Apple's 100 retreat, I think you had them on the slide, John.
Yeah, from a couple years ago, the years old ones.
Oh yeah, they're years. Like it was like, yeah, Jobs was still learning the show at that point. Literally, well, first of all, they don't look very good, which is kind of funny. Mm-hmm. And second of all, at one point, they literally just say, like, let's increase platform lock-in, which we know everybody thinks about, but just to see it on the slide was, I found that interesting.
Yeah, that was, I think, 2010, and it was in the context of switching their message from, the Mac or PC as your digital hub to the cloud being your hub. Right. And that the advantage to this would be that it increases the lock-in. And I think they actually used the word lock-in.
Yeah, they did. They were not, because it was just an internal document.
Right.
To only apparently like the 100 most important people at Apple, quote unquote, when like that's the idea of that meeting.
You know, it's funny. It's easy to look at that and like the word lock in and think of that as an evil thing to do. But that just seems like good business to me.
It can be evil and good business, which is what I think it kind of is. Which is fine, but I don't know. It's not something that they ever really talk about. Like Microsoft famously was, you know, like from the file formats to everything was like pretty much into lock in. When they had a grip on everything. Apple has managed to escape that kind of criticism for the most part, except for like the Unix, you know, everything must be free kind of people. Or like, the anti-DRM.
Crew. Yeah, the iTunes people get complaints.
Right. What is it that you guys are worried about? Let's just ask each of you in turn before we wrap up. Normally, I like to end on a high note, but, you know, let's just depress some people. Brent, what concerns you the most?
It's the unknown unknowns. You know, we'll have our first day and there'll be, you know, a whole lot of people, I'm sure. And, you know, I've done and I'm continuing to do everything I can to prepare for that. But, you know, I haven't run an online service with thousands, many, many thousands of users in quite a number of years. Right. And, you know, the tech has changed. Everything has changed. So I just don't know how that's going to be. You know, I'd set the thing to auto scale so it can go up to like 10 instances or something if I need to.
Oh, cool. So you click the scaling flag.
I clicked the scaling flag. I totally did.
It's not a problem. Yeah. Done. And, you know, problem solved.
And, you know, we have a stats thing so we can watch, you know, the users come in and, you know, Azure gives us nice graphs so I can see what's happening and all that kind of stuff. So I'll know what's going on, but, you know, how do I monitor how well it's performing for all these people? I don't know. Cause I can check it myself. Sync seems fast. Well, maybe I'm the lucky one. Right. Yeah. So I just don't know. That said, I'm not terribly worried. I think probably I'll have a crazy amount of adrenaline for a few days and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Right. Yeah. You'll either be drunk or completely sober and like.
Right. Or on the other.
There's going to be an extreme situation going on.
Yeah.
Dave, what worries you? Not just about your app or Vesper, just, you know.
In general? Oh, you were opening a big can of worms.
Dying alone.
Okay, okay.
Dying let's not alone.
It a little bit. Yeah.
Dial it back. It's there's little things, little decisions that we made that I don't feel nervous about. It's not that I question the decision. Sometimes I question people's reaction. I called out one earlier, the when you create an account only having one password field. I know that's a conversation I'm going to have more than once after this thing comes out. And there's going to be a part of me, there should always be a part of me that looks back at that and says, was this the right call? Should we have done this? Should we have given this more thought? Which is hopefully a sign that our hearts are in the right places and we're doing the right things. But those are the sorts of things that worry me, the little details. It would be easy to worry about scale or people's notes not syncing. A lot of that is just me having faith in Brent and how well things came together. I think that during the beta, if there were any bugs from by the time we put this onto people's real phones, messing with real data, we had done a lot of internal assumption checking and Brent had done, you know, all these months of work. By the time we put it on people's phones, the number of bugs that we got related to sync itself, if it's not zero, it's really close.
Right.
And so unknowns, I guess, would be the thing. Maybe there's something that we didn't account for there that we...
Yeah, that's just like the healthy paranoia level.
Right. It's like it's almost been too smooth to a certain degree. But, you know, it's mostly, at least in my realm, the little details that we'll have time to go back and make changes and stuff later. But those are things that I worry about.
Right. John?
I guess I worry most about the trend in people not wanting to pay for apps, period, no matter what they cost. And because I don't know. I feel like that I don't know what to do in a world where people don't buy apps. The good news on that front, I mean, fresh, I think like literally last night, is that our friends at the Omni Group released the big new OmniFocus 2 for Mac, and it's $40 and $80 for the pro version, and it broke their online store because so many people were buying it, which is good for them, but good news is a general sign that at least on the Mac, that, you know, that people are still willing to spend decent, not exorbitant money, but real money for quality. And so that really does me well, because that's my concern. And I really, really, really... And, you know, this is as old as the App Store, but I don't know that it's gotten better. And I feel like the whole in-app purchasing trend has made it worse. You know, I just don't want to see it where you can't make it work financially by selling a quality app at a fair price.
I'm curious to see a more analytical – we can't because Apple has all the numbers. But there's so many more people putting out apps now. The failures – the number of failures are greater. The fact that this in-app purchasing sort of floats you to the top is true. But I don't know if that tanks businesses like ours, right? Like smaller shops that either sold direct or now through the App Store. I don't know how much that's affecting sort of our level of company.
Yeah, I don't know. I just cannot, you know, Dave can go on a rant about it, but, you know, where is this world where $4.99 for a quality app is really something that you want to argue about for hours? You know, I mean, isn't the time that some people will spend arguing about a $2, $3, $4 app is more time than the money is worth.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think apps are magical and they're free and they're like ephemeral, like they exist when you push a button on your phone, and I think so the App Store has made people like, and by people I mean like the broadest audience possible, comfortable with the idea of acquiring software. App, like, people don't talk about software, people buy apps. And that in turn has kind of sort of set the psychology around it, that it's like, well, these are basically just goodies I can get on my phone if I toss a few pennies at people. It used to be, I think, when software was sold direct, an exchange between an interested buyer and the person selling the piece of software. And you had a relationship there. I think the App Store has changed that relationship to be like a relationship with Apple. And then you're getting more goodies from like this third party that you don't necessarily really care about. Is that, do you think that's like, does that make sense to you? Or
I'm thinking,
is that just rejected?
This, the notion that came up earlier in the conversation about the app isn't the binary, the app is the idea, the app is the concept.
Right.
That's, I don't know, that I'm going to, that's going to be kicking around my head for a couple of weeks, I think.
The experience.
Yeah, the app is the experience. It's one of those things that, like John was saying earlier, that there's things you just know intuitively, and to have it like codified and have it like sitting there in front of me, it's like the most obvious thing. Well, of course, that's how this is. And how that changes our thinking about anything we do. I don't know. I'll need some time to think about that. But the more I'm thinking about that, the more I'm unconcerned about the individual pieces. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because if the goal is we just want to make a really great note-taking experience, then which platform we go to next or what we charge for this, it'll all be informed by that one goal.
Right. No, that totally makes sense. I hate the term user experience designer. Just because I don't believe you can design experiences for people.
Oh, say that at an art museum, man.
Well, that's different because you're designing a space like Disneyland or, you know, casinos, that kind of thing. You can design the entire space. An application, I don't think you can design an experience.
Why not?
Why is it not an experience? I mean, we have a design, people use it, the animations do this, the things do that. How is that not an experience?
So the interaction with the application is an experience. Like,
sure.
You know, like a game design, you can design what the player's experience is going to be as they move through the game. But in an application for something like a phone, the experience is different whether you're on a bus or you're sitting at home, or like there's a greater environmental thing going on there that I think you kind of need to take into account.
Of course.
And I don't think that like we're going to design your experience is the proper way to be thinking about it, because you can't design their experience. You can only design an interaction for them. And hopefully that'll lead to the best experience. Does that make sense? I'm like,
I think I know what you're talking about.
Cutting hairs here. Like it's silly.
Yeah. I think maybe too much focus on the word experience, but I see where you're coming from, where there's a lot outside of our control.
Yes. Yeah.
And I
firmly believe in interaction design. Experience design kind of just, and it really is just the word experience.
It's the same thing. I mean, people at Disneyland, that's a design experience, but there's a ton of stuff that you won't know about. The designers don't know about that person's background or the kind of day they've been having, or maybe a family member just passed away. There's, or the weather that day. There's a lot of things that they can only kind of account for. Right.
Or the frog at the Anchor.
we can design for as much of the experience as we can account for, but I still think of that very much as an experience. And the reason the word experience matters to me is because of the human connection. There's a person on the other side of the glass here. And okay, if I'm thinking so about that, the experience, I can keep that connection going.
That I understand. Maybe I just take that for granted. In UI design, user interaction design or user interface, I totally get it. It's the word experience that just...
You know, I don't even, I might even end up taking your side on this, because what I prefer is human interaction design.
That sold. We can be friends.
All right. I'm glad we worked that out.
Not only that, but you like, so user experience is abbreviated to UX, which is just like, fuck you. You can't even abbreviate this correctly. It just makes me mad. I'm just angry.
You know what that is? I swear to God, I think that it's this, that X is the coolest letter of the alphabet. I do.
It is.
I'm telling you, it's the coolest letter of the alphabet. And that's why it's Mac OS X or Mac OS X, however you want it. It just looks cool.
Yeah.
That's correct. Why they've stuck with it.
But you know what? You don't get to use it at, like, as an excuse.
Right. So saying that you're a UX designer sounds like you're halfway to being a secret agent, whereas you're a UI designer, it just sounds like, you know.
Right. But that's partly what bugs me is that, like, you're using that X. Just you don't – there's no reason to be using that X.
You're, well, you're X-Men and not B-Men.
You're appropriating it.
Right.
It used to be pejorative, brand X.
Yeah, but I could see how you could make brand X really cool.
Do you know what? We have a line of stuff.
Generation X.
Called, No Name.
Yeah.
It's like the generics, like the supermarket has a bunch of generic stuff, and it's just literally called the No Name brand, and it's all in yellow packages with no name on it.
Made by the government.
Close enough.
It's Soviet soap from the 80s.
Nobody ever
tastes, gotten. Tastes great, though.
Dave, the opposite of Guy's last question, instead of what do you fear, what are you hoping for with Vesper 2.0?
Ah, don't be nice to them.
I hope that – I'm trying to think how I want to say this. Going back to the money, like, do people pay for apps? Do people pay for services? I hope the answer continues to be yes, and I hope that we get to keep doing this for long enough to prove that that money – mean something, that we're providing the kind of value that people want for that money. And that's not even a bigger conversation about whether or not people should pay for apps. I just mean for us, I hope that we get to keep making Vesper for the foreseeable future, and we get to keep making the next version of the thing and keep showing people that where when the first version of the app came out, you could look at it and you could say $5 for a notes app that doesn't seems like a lot of money. With this release or with the next release or the next whatever we're doing, I hope that more and more it becomes obvious where that money has gone.
John, anything different?
I hope that that we're correct, that it turns out to be amazingly cheap to run the servers.
Cheers.
I didn't really mean it as a joke. We have a pretty solid, it's not just a vague hunch. We have, some good back of the envelope calculations. But it'll make a big difference as to what our future plans are. And it's, I'm very, very confident that it is technically sound. Nice. I'm just curious to see how it turns out cost-wise in practice.
Brent?
At the moment, my horizons are fairly short-term. I'm just hoping for a great first week where I'm not up 24/7 doing weird things to the server. If I can get past that, things will be great.
Let me tell you, that is the only sort of, I don't want to say engineer, but like that is exactly the way a programmer thinks. Like the future, I just hope this does not explode.
That's right.
The furthest I can see is the point where something's just going to break. And I don't even want to think about that. Mm-hmm.
And I hope that beyond that, I do hope that I get to the Mac app really soon and it goes well and quickly and we release that, because I so want that Mac app.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
That will really change the way that I use Vesper. Like, I still sometimes use reminders just because it syncs.
Sure, yeah.
My Mac to Vesper sync mechanism thus far has been to write things in the Notes app and then open the Notes app on my phone and paste it into Vesper.
Yeah. I've actually done that a couple times, yeah. Yeah.
I've emailed myself too. I've text messaged myself with iMessage.
Well, it makes so much sense though, because the iPhone is a thing that you always want with you on the go, because you can put stuff in or take it out when you need it. But the Mac is where you can just do a ton of stuff very quickly. And the iPad kind of sits in between for aggregation and reporting, but it's not. It doesn't seem to me like to be either end of that solution.
Well, where were you when I was asked why we're doing Mac next? That's
the perfect. He was writing that article.
You just did it in 7 seconds. Somebody write that down.
Done.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of surprised that we managed to keep it together without just going way off into the weeds.
I want to get back to Independence Day.
Right, exactly. The White House explodes. That's kind of awesome. Data is a horrible scientist. That guy's a shitty actor. Don't understand.
Brent Spiner.
Yeah. All right. Get out of here, kids. See you in 2 weeks, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, totally. Yeah.
Week and a half.
Let me just ask the obvious question. John, I know almost everybody knows, but in the off chance there's one person who doesn't know where to find you, where can they go?
So John Gruber writes at kickingbear.com. You should send you his ad money there.
You can find me at daringfireball.net.
And the talk show has just moved there as well, so they can find all your stuff at one place now.
Just go there and you'll find it all.
Brent?
You can find me at inessential.com.
Dave?
BetterElevation.com.
Very nice. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. That was a lot of fun. Obviously. Yeah,
good show.
Yeah. Talk to you soon.